Welcome to the official podcast of PHP Architect. Join us to listen to the latest news and tech talk from our conferences, the magazine, and wider PHP community.
Welcome to the PHP Architect Podcast. We're a consulting company that publishes a monthly magazine about PHP and related topics. We also host a PHP conference in Chicago next year. It's going to be April 27th through the 29th. And you can submit to our CFP today, and you can buy early bird tickets. You can join us live in the show in our Discord at discord.phparch.com. We also have a swag store that you can check out at store.phparch.com. With me this week is Holly Schilling and Sarah Goldman. How's it going?
I'm doing drugs.
Great to start off with that, of course.
Yeah, show's instantly over.
Listening to it, like, not the illegal kind, just the legal ones.
The illegal kind right now.
But
I'll get the good shit later.
You're just priming your insulin pump, right? Or not priming?
Yeah, that's filling. What I'm doing right now. Yeah.
Okay. Still not. I'm not familiar with quite all the machinery, but like that's a little tiny tube you got there.
Yeah. Well, this is a super high tech device which has, let me see, a motor that pushes a stick into a tube. Because medicine is high tech. This was almost on camera when I put it this in about 5 minutes ago. So PHP, that's a fun thing. Hey, so's the swag store.
Yeah, the swag store is pretty cool. Yeah, this is store.phparch.com. Feel free to check it out.
This is my PHP Arch hoodie from the swag store. It's awesome. I love it. It is great in my basement / dungeon. So, call for papers is open for PHP Tech. It goes through the end of August. So, as you're listening to this, today is like the 30th. Yeah, 30th. We'll go with that. Of July, as we record this, and you're probably listening to it sometime after that. So, you have till the end of August. Get in your call for papers submitted, and come see us at PHP Tech.
If you're listening to it before then, let's talk. That's pretty cool.
Yeah, if you're listening before this, can you please give us like a transcript or something we can go to prepare better? Because we have not done all the due diligence in preparing. So if you have this already recorded and you're listening to it live, or you're listening to it in the past, please write it down so we can read it live.
So here's the thing: when this episode ends, it's already going to be July 31st for me, and you will be listening to it still on the 30th. So I think we've got that covered, actually.
I think so. Yeah, I think this checks out.
Time travel real. Birds aren't real. And shit, what was the end of that punchline? I got nothing. Hi.
I did do a PR to the PHP web site this morning that I was mocked for my transposition of hours, times, and seconds in regard to a cache control header expiration calculation being set. And I fully admit that I jumble my minutes, seconds, and hours around, and the Europeans are making fun of me for it, and it's fine.
Now, as a former American, I will say that I have always found the ordering of month, day, year to be absolutely absurd. It's like outer Endian. Nobody, who has ever heard of outer Endian as a byte ordering? That makes no goddamn sense.
I agree. I couldn't agree more. And somehow I haven't been able to break myself of it and fully adopt. Like, even though I very easily took to 24-hour time clock, I've started to do some measurement units and, you know, trying to convert that to metric as well, to try to like make sure I'm staying kind of not like adopting one system or the other, but just trying to like, you know, keep my distances and such in line.
No, I will say this all day, but I will die on the hill of Fahrenheit. That's the only one that
I think too. I think Celsius is a terrible way to measure temperature, because Fahrenheit is, there's such a difference to me between 72 degrees and 71 degrees. Mm-hmm.
If you want to center humans as the most important thing in the universe, then I agree. Fahrenheit is a lovely system. If you're going to be specist about it, fine.
But why shouldn't we be?
Water probably exists on a lot more planets than humans do.
But as long as we're being species to the ones that we only, to the only species we know about, which is us, then it's fine, right? It's fine that we're the center of the galaxy.
We're the only ones referring to it in these unit of measures. So like, it doesn't really matter if like the rock cares, it's 3000 degrees Kelvin. Okay, sure. That's great for the rock. I don't the rock.
The rock doesn't matter. The rock doesn't care.
It is definitely not 3,000 kelvins, though, I will assure you of that. That's a hot fucking rock.
I'm aware of that, but that's what I'm saying. Like, that's lava at that point, or like gaseous, whatever. But
that's lava rock is what that is.
Okay, I don't know the exact boiling point of rock, but I mean, it is pretty high.
I mean, it would be 627 Celsius, which would make it in your freedom units like a good 1150, 1200 Fahrenheit or something like that.
I think rock
probably melts by then.
I think Google just schooled me.
The conversions of like Celsius to Fahrenheit. I just don't see the value of Celsius. But
according to Google, rocks do not have a single boiling point because they are made out of many different minerals.
Naturally.
Well,
Vaporize or boil molten rock into a gas, temperatures usually must go above 3,000 Celsius or 5,400 Fahrenheit freedom units.
Okay.
There it is.
It's not boiled away. But is it lava, even if it's not vapor? Because boiling is not the same as melting.
Right. Yes. Sorry. I was conflating some of those. But this actually says to vaporize or boil. I think. Maybe the vaporization happens at those higher temperatures, the higher ends of the temperatures, and you boil maybe lower.
Well, I'm thinking of ore extraction. Like you take iron ore and you want to get like iron out of it. You don't have to go to 3,000 degrees to melt iron out of the ore and vaporize the dirty rock components.
It'd be a lot cooler if you did, though.
It would be cooler, but it also would have slowed down the progress of human civilization because it would have taken a lot longer to, you know, reach the Iron Age than it did.
That's fair.
Probably. You know, A Woods is saying in chat, and now that he's learned Celsius, he likes it better. Easy to learn. And the things that's hard to learn is kilograms. I don't know who's got moderation authority in our chat, but ban A Woods, please.
All right. Unpopular opinion. I don't give a fuck between any of these measurements. I care what is the most common language.
Right. And what's the shared experience?
That's metric. I'm sorry.
And let's relate to the most shared experience, in my opinion.
I'm sorry. Right? How much do the Brits weigh? How do we measure weight in the British system?
Well, let's see. I think I come in at about five and a half, 6 stone, something like that.
Exactly. Like, no, if you're going to call out, like, oh, this is a system for like, whatever, stone. Like, we're going to start to throw out their stone and be like, Brits, you got to change. And they're going to die on that hill. Like,
that was a weird callback. World War. No. That was a weird callback to boiling and vaporizing stone, but I guess I'll allow it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't even think of that. No, I will say this. Nobody younger than me, and I'm half a century old, nobody younger than me uses stone. Let's just be very clear.
It's fair.
It's boomer energy is what it is.
I know a stone is 14 pounds
is a different problem.
I had to admit in chat earlier about building a graphing calculator in Visual Basic 4. Visual Basic, like to build the graphing calculator application, because that's how old I am.
Yeah,
it was cool. I had my TIA 82. But I can build this on my computer. I can build this on Windows. And I did. It was great. I'm old.
Yeah, 82. Luxury. My day, we were lucky to have a Casio with a solar panel.
My first Visual Studio C was 6, I think.
Visual Basic. Say the same because
Visual Basic 6. Not C, Visual C was something that was a different version, I think. But yeah, my first Visual Basic that I actually did productive things with was 6, and I spent like maybe 3 months doing anything with it before I jumped ship.
In terms of Visual Basic specifically, yes, Visual Basic 6. But like that was like post Q Basic and like 1,000 other basic dialects. See, kids, back in our day, you know, the best language you could get a hold of had line numbers that you had to declare, and that's how you moved your program around. Was just
no, that's actually not as fair, because like even QBasic didn't require line numbers. You could use them.
Well, I'm going pre QBasic now because there were dialects before that.
I mean, there's Apple Basic required them, and like a lot of the basic dialects back then did, but like QBasic was the start of they weren't necessary. You could put in there a label. I still remember like learning about the magic of subroutines. I'm like, what if I need this? It's just going to come back to where I started from? And then I'm like, oh, there it right. is. Okay.
Yeah, there's the connection.
Back when GoTo was not a controversial language construct, it was just how you wrote a program.
Yeah.
It can't be terrible if that's the way everybody does it, because that's the way the interpreter or the compiler wants it, right?
Yeah. It's how your machine code works. Mm-hmm. Sometimes.
So, getting back on track a little bit, maybe.
PHP!
Let's talk about PSR3. What's going on with logging in PSR3?
Well, I saw this come across the social feeds, and Marco Pavetta is a friend of many PHP developers. He is a fantastic person to have a conversation with about PHP, or just about system architecture or architecture in general. He is fantastic. He is over in Italy. And we'll every so often blog about this. He's blogging on this one specifically is talking about proper logging with PSR3, which this sounds like super basic stuff. But what I really thought was interesting here is that you're coming down here and you're actually kind of he's giving you some input and some guidance on injecting loggers with dependency injection, and also coming across some different patterns of some logs are better than no logs. And a lot of times people will have either a ton of logs that they're not actually capturing because they're overly descriptive in a very like high log level. So their logs are they have tons of logs if they're ever in info, but they're never running their production apps in info logging mode. So they never see those great logs that they have. So he covers a lot of the stuff like that. Also using the logger for measurements and being able to grep and find analytics data based on log events happening. He points it out. It's like, you know, you can do this, but you know, honestly, OTEL metrics are really the better way of doing this. But you can also do log duration stuff. Fantastic blog post. We'll have a link for it. But yeah, I thought it was pretty interesting.
I mean, yes, you should be logging. Like, is that controversial?
No, I don't think it's controversial at all. I think what he's just saying here is this is how you can log with a minimal amount of dependencies, because a lot of times when you say or when you search for add logging to this application, you're pulling in three or four dependencies, you're having to wire up a bunch of configuration stuff, and that's not necessarily the case if you're just using something that's PSR3 compatible, just because it's so much of that those upstream decisions have already been made for you just by sticking with the PSR.
Yeah.
Whenever I read a logging function or anything like that, I always feel like there has to be a better way to do this, to like call each log than like this.logger.error.info or whatever. Like, I feel like that's a lot of prep work for send a message to the log. I don't know. Maybe is there a better way I'm missing on that ever?
I'm not sure. Say that first part again.
The example you've got on the screen right now, there is talking about like yeah. this.logger, not dot logger, this arrow logger, arrow right. error.
I mean, is that too much?
That's a lot. Like for every time you send a log message, it feels like it's a little heavy.
Well, you
grab the logger property and call its log method. Like that's two steps.
I mean, yeah, but it's like, what is it? 25 characters,
and see, this is just so ingrained into my brain. This looks anything other than this wouldn't look right. Right. You know, it's just.
I know you're right, but it's like I just want to. Okay,
alternative is a helper is a static method.
Yeah,
a concrete class or an implemented class. I mean, that's the alternative, right? That if you're going for pure character count, and if you want to subscribe to some things that people believe, such as visual debt. Which mm-hmm. I think is a little silly, but if you want to subscribe to that kind of thing, PHP will let you do that.
All right, yeah. So I got it. Here's the new RFC. We're going to define a built-in that'll be just the emoji for a log. And then the log you just emoji. Put parens on it, and then that just figures out the right severity level. It just logs it.
We should derail 8.6's timeline and get this in right now. I mean, let's just stop the timeline process, get this approved and voted, make it happen.
Actually, no, we'll just have they'll just be functions. You'll have the, you know, the log emoji, that'll just be an info level log, and that'll just be a function. You call that, it goes to the log. And then there'll be like, you know, fire for an error logging level, and that'll be a pull for a panic.
You know, as random as that sounds, I actually kind of love that.
I mean, to talk about visual debt, I think I could actually understand those relative severities. Like a log, a fire, and a poop.
That's not even the worst idea questions? I've ever heard. I kind of love it.
So just to kind of go back to where that this logger is, and then the level is coming from. In this example, the log for logging durations, you have final class, and then the constructor is where that interface is being injected. So that's where we're getting that this logger debug. If that wasn't clear in the example further down.
So you know, maybe log what, smarter, maybe what
I'm thinking
harder.
Of is just like the addition of the this on the front. I guess that's what I'm probably indexing on too much. Like, if it were a local variable, I don't know.
I will say this. Different languages take different approaches on this. PHP makes you use dollar this. Python makes you use self dot. C++, just like, hey, you reference a property and it'll check the current instance and it'll pull it out of that instance somewhere. You don't need to say this, but you can. You can say literally this arrow property name. Personally, I actually kind of like having this on there. It makes it really explicit. This is not a scope level variable. This is a instance property.
It is.
And it's immediately apparent.
With implicit declarations of variables, like that would that's absolutely necessary in PHP. I'm not arguing against it. Just like that's probably what it is, like visually, that sets me off every time I see that.
Yeah. No, I get that.
You know, if we ever got to, you know, PHP 10 and we have no implicit declarations for variables of locals anymore, then maybe we can talk about it again.
All right, so I personally like having explicit variable declarations, and if that were something that I could opt into, I would opt into it. But there is a tendency, and we go through cycles of this, where it feels like sometimes we're trying to make PHP into a different language, and we could always just build a new language if that's what we want. It doesn't have to be called PHP.
One of the things I keep hearing is that PHP needs X because YZV languages have it. And it's like, okay, well, maybe we do, but also what's stopping you from going and using those languages if that's the better tool for the job, right? And I think some people are trying to conflate the fact that the PHP Foundation and others are trying to revitalize and review the onboarding process for getting people into PHP. And they're saying, well, we have to have all these things to attract all of these potential developers. And I don't think that's what we need. I think just redoing and updating and revamping the onboarding process is a fantastic place to start. I don't think that you have to go chase these features necessarily for would be developers that may or may not even ever use the language for said features, right?
We have an incredible language as it is. And the fact that there are people still running on 5 whatever tells you that it's been an incredible language for a very long time. Yeah, we could put new features in. And a lot of the features we put in have really good reasons for going. It's like, oh, this makes X better, either safer or faster or easier to use. That's great. But that's not the only thing that's going to keep people interested in PHP. PHP being just a fast, easy to use, well documented language is going to do that to a large degree too.
I'm going to call out the thing that you guys have both missed so far. It's the ecosystem. I can write Swift on the server using Vapor and a handful of other tools, but you know what? I don't have the ecosystem. It's like there's so much ecosystem. You can think of anything you can think of. You're like, okay, I need to do whatever. Great. Here it is. I had someone on Mastodon, and I'm blanking on this. They were like, hey, your code on your blog isn't readable. There's a PHP library for that. Here's Tempest. Like, pull it in. Mm-hmm. And I'm blanking on the name here, and I should be pulling this up live, and I'm not. But thank you to whoever that person is. It's their library, Tempest, and I should be remembering it, and I'm totally blanking because we're live. But
I would say I haven't missed it. I took it as a given because that is one of PHP's strengths, and I just assume everybody knows that.
Well, speaking of assuming
this, you probably are aware of that. But like, that's something that keeps a lot of gravity around the PHP ecosystem, the environment, because of that ecosystem. Because whatever you need, it's here. That's also why, like, there's conversations in internals, and I'm not calling anybody else out, but like, they're all like, "Hey, such and such language has this. We could build it that way." And like, or if you want to use that, go to that language. Well, we can make PHP a little bit better. We could add a few more features. But at the end of the day, the ecosystem is what's keeping people here.
I kind of wonder. I keep trying to avoid AI, but I stay aware of it. I wonder if AI might be a little better at PHP just because we're, as a community, actually really good about putting our shit on GitHub. So it's probably a hell of a lot more to learn from. Not necessarily good stuff, because all the PHP 4 slop is still out there.
I wouldn't discount that idea.
In chat is helping me out here. Brent Ruse, I'm not going to say that wrong. It's not one of my three names, I know. But yes, that's who does Tempest. Thank you. That was him who I spoke to on Mastodon.
And speaking of something that more people should know about, let's hear from this week's partner.
Thank you to our partners over at CodeRabbit for sponsoring this episode. Code reviews are critical but time-consuming. CodeRabbit acts as your AI co-pilot, providing instant code review comments and potential impacts of every pull request. Beyond just flagging issues, CodeRabbit provides one-click fix suggestions and lets you define custom code quality rules using AST grep patterns, catching subtle issues that traditional static analysis tools might miss. CodeRabbit reviews 1 million PRs every week across 3 million repositories and is used by 100,000 open source projects. CodeRabbit is free for all open source repos. Get started today by visiting phpa.me/CodeRabbit. Again, that is phpa.me/CodeRabbit.
Thanks, CodeRabbit. And my favorite part about using CodeRabbit is the little poem you get, or a little haiku you get out in every PR. It's pretty great.
It is. I need my own personal CodeRabbit subscription. Like, when I do work with PHP Architect, I get to use it because it's their subscription and they're paying for it. But when I'm doing my own stuff, I don't have it and I miss it. Like, it's really nice. I like it.
Nice things about CodeRabbit. That's my contribution. I'm retired.
Like,
I don't
when you get used to a tool and you then like you just take it away and like you don't have it for a project, you're like, oh, this is where my CodeRabbit usually runs. What the hell? And now I can't touch Cursor anymore because that's owned by Nazis. So
don't use the Nazi tools.
No. What kind of world have we like devolved into where it's like the Nazis are back, they're running some of the AI tools, what the hell? I don't know.
Well, on the subject of AI and dealing with
Joe's just like, leave the Nazis over there.
on the subject of using AI tools, our friend Gemma posted this blog post yesterday, about it's titled Infrastructure and Other Paradoxes. And I thought this was a really great write-up. She talks about how she's using AI LLMs to plan infrastructure, and how it's not going, you know, it goes kind of well and what it's doing well and what it's not really doing. And it's really interesting to step through where she's talking about how the prompt she's giving it is she needs a system for creating, maintaining deterministic reproducible server configurations so that she can maintain a fleet of bare metal Linux-based hosts without worrying about configuration drift. And what are some of the solutions in this modern ecosystem? And I love her writing here where it says, Claude glues my query to the end of my global instructions and spins away, recombining water-powered human creativity and intellectual property into a story of Markdown, the universal engineering language in 2026. Couldn't be more true. But what's cool here is you know, she's being exposed to these tools that the LLM's been trained on, such as Terraform, Kubernetes, Nix, NixOS, GUIX, and then she was walking through this, doing a proof of concept, and then she's talking about using Proxmox, but Proxmox isn't the right thing because it's an appliance, it's not an actual application. She's trying to find something that can fold all of these things together, and ultimately what it kind of comes up to is she is now, thanks to the LLM, she's looking at potentially adding 4 brand new tools to her team that none of the team are currently experts on. And that's always a risk, right? So one of the things that we do at PHP Architect internally is we always ask lots of questions when it comes to bringing a new tool into the ecosystem, into our projects. It's like, what are we getting out of this tool? So it's to have something like 4 new tools being introduced into an environment or into a project would be like a really big deal. And she talks about that in this. And she, you know, she's talking about how she's building the foundation of this thing that's going to kind of go on for a really long time and have a ton of users. And it has to be this robust thing. And she's even talks about, you know, what's working well out of this and then what really isn't. So I don't know. It's a really interesting read, especially if you're into doing infrastructure and such.
Yeah, I have to admit, I only skimmed it before we recorded. But yeah, they do. It's really common for new tools to be thrown at you through AI. Like, you can be talking to it and it'd be like, hey, try this tool. And sometimes, yeah, this is the missing piece you needed. And sometimes it's like, where the hell did you get that pick from? I have no idea where some of those come from. So, like, AI can never replace the human aspect of thinking about things and, like, actually evaluating it and, you know, fitness for cause and can my team maintain this? Like, the AI does not replace that. Like, there's a lot of people talking about, like, AI replacing jobs and all that. And, like, it's definitely shifting a lot, but it's not, it never can replace people.
But you do get exposed to new things. And it's like, we couldn't ever get exposed to new things before AI. We definitely didn't, you know, read blog posts and comprehend new information and for in our own brains and pick up things along the way. That definitely didn't happen.
Right, but I think it does accelerate the process. I your point is well-founded, but like it does accelerate that process because in one you can ask one question and it can throw back 10 different tools at you. And the other part, then you don't have to feel like dumb. Like if you posted on Stack Overflow 10 years ago, you get back, oh, this is a repeat question, do a search, RTFM, like any of those kinds of feedback, you can ask dumb questions to AI and they don't care. I'd ask a lot of dumb questions to AI.
In fairness, you should search for your question first. I'm just saying.
Yeah. And what I wanted to point out was there was an article just today on Inc.com talking about how 55% of the leadership they surveyed for this article came back and said that they were regretting major layoffs and that the reversal of those major layoffs has begun. And it lists out several companies, Ford being one, which was they had posted an article last month or so talking about how they had to very specifically go back and rehire some of their graybeards because nobody knew how the sausage was being made and nobody could fix the software and they had let everybody go. And this article claims that this is going to are this is forcing forcing companies to start rehiring in the junior roles and the entry level roles. But I think that it's more, it needs to be more than that, because your entry level people aren't going to be the ones that know how all that software works. It's those graybeards. Mm-hmm. It's the older workforce that you let go or you let retire early that took that knowledge with them. And you need those entry level people to come in and learn. But it was interesting for me to see in that Inc. article that they actually called out, the companies were actually calling out the issue that letting all those people go and not properly training what they knew and what their skills were into the AI that replaced them was a disaster. It's like, well, if only we could have seen this coming, right?
Nobody could have foreseen it.
If only people were talking about this and saying that this was probably a bad idea to do these widespread massive layoffs that are still happening today. I mean, mm-hmm. the gaming industry has been hit really hard the past 6 months.
And that's absolutely a thing that's happening. Like, it's hard to argue about it because there are people getting laid off, but I still don't think it's... There have always been these kinds of layoffs. Every time there's a change in leadership or a change in anything, like the whole market goes crazy when people get taken over. Like, oh, we're going to replace all these knowledgeable, experienced people because they're so expensive. We're going to replace them with junior developers. We're going to replace them with, mm-hmm. you know, fewer people because now we've got automation and tools and all this. Like, it's a different scale it's happening at right now, but it's still the same process we've had in the industry for 20 years.
And the scary thing to me is the scale, right? Mm-hmm. That's millions of people, if not hundreds of thousands more people than what it was just by automation.
Yeah.
I mean, you're always going to have automation and process improvement drive more efficiency, and more efficiency is typically going to be fewer jobs depending on the market. But I think AI is definitely improving efficiency for developers, but I think it's enabling a lot of developers to just ship crap. And then it's also enabling people to ship really good potential changes. But if you still don't fundamentally understand the changes that you're applying to the system or how your changes are going to affect the running system, you're still no better off than somebody who just knows absolutely nothing and you're just writing a bunch of gibberish. So I think there's still trade-offs and you have to find that balance.
Oh, for sure. Like, I've been getting a lot of flack, not a lot. I've been getting some flack from the PRs and work I've been doing with internals because I have not written a single line of this like 10,000 lines of code by hand. Mm. But I'm actually a C developer long before I was in mobile and anything else. Like, C is where I got started into mobile because I knew C, which naively I was told would translate well into Objective-C, which is a total lie, and it did not.
Oh, that is a lie, yeah.
But like, Objective-C is almost C. You can do this, right? Yeah, okay.
I can objectively see that is a lie.
We don't do it because it's easy. We do it because we thought it would be easy. That's it. I was a C developer for a long time and learned it because, we talked about that before. But like, I know all the code. I could, like, the AI is making me faster, it's making me more accurate, but it's not giving me, like, if I didn't know how to read and refine the code and, like, stop it, if I didn't know what not to ship, that's almost as important as what to build and how to build it at this stage. Because, yeah, I can say Fable is amazing. Fable is like a superpower. But also, like, you have to be able to say, hey, Fable, no, let's not do that. That was bad. We're going to go back and fix that. Or reverse that commit when we're going to do this a different way because that breaks something else. Your AI can't do that. You need those gray beards. You need those experienced leadership kind of people.
It's true.
So on the subject of AI, something AI adjacent, Codeberg is a site, codeberg.org. Is a site that they have a big header on their website that says software development, but free. They're a nonprofit community-led effort that provides services to free and open source projects, such as Git hosting, using ForgeJO, Pages, CI/CD, and a Weblate instance. I'm not entirely sure what that is.
So, I mean, Codeberg came out of like the backlash against GitHub. the eight. Uh-oh. Wrong one. There we go. So they came out of like kind of a pushback of GitHub was scraping all the pages. They wanted to, like, they're billing people more. They're raising kind of fees. And that's kind of where Codeberg came from. And just recently, just a couple days ago, they came out with a new policy against AI vibe coded kind of work. Not only like they don't allow AI and things to scrape theirs, but now you can't even commit to. Uh-oh. What's up, Sarah?
You keep talking. I was trying not to interrupt you.
You're making hand gestures on my screen. I stop. I don't know. I can't.
I said, Joe, I need to go. Take me off the screen.
You know, we have a private chat for that.
She did use it, to be fair.
Oh, I didn't read it. I should probably read this, too. Anyway, so it just is a really interesting position that they've taken of that they don't allow even use cases. If you are AI coding or using AI tools, they don't allow you to use their service anymore. And the arguments they make are a little questionable. I respect the position, but I also think it's probably going to be the end of Codeberg, because realistically, the people who are in open source that I've met, like, are usually the more experienced ones, and we can, you know, use AI as a force multiplier to do a lot more things. So it will be interesting to see how this plays out. Joe, any thoughts on this, or have you read this?
I have read through some of their stuff. I actually signed up for an account. I felt like this was a stronger offering and in terms of being compared to something like Tangle.org, which was, are you familiar with Tangle.org?
I'm not, actually.
It's kind of like the same thing, where it's supposed to be a GitHub alternative, but it's built on top of the AT protocol. So there's some advantages and disadvantages there. The thing that really kind of stopped me from really doing more with Tangled was, as a GitHub potential replacement or backup offsite GitHub, was essentially that, like, there's no two-factor auth available at the moment. So it's like, well, that's one thing that GitHub really does well, is they have all that stuff locked down behind my multiple two-factor authentication methods. I don't want to sacrifice that. But Codeberg does have that, right? So I signed up for them, had two-factor auth. I would have no problem creating repos and sharing code there on Codeberg. My concern or question would be, what I didn't necessarily see spelled out was, how are they policing this? I mean, unless... like, is it you get reported for your bad behavior and that's when they shut you down or smack your hand or something? I guess I'm not trying to abuse this or anything, but I'm just trying to question, what's that enforcement look like?
Well, I mean, my suspicion, so this is kind of early, I don't know any of this officially yet, but my suspicion is that they're going to look for, like, the Claude Code kind of signature on commits, is my suspicion. And then secondly, they have a line in this document that says, like, if the amount of work is disproportionate to the number of contributors to it, which is kind of, I think, what they're going to do. If one person does 25 commits a day and, you know, 40,000 lines of code, they're going to kind of suspect things. So
yeah,
that's my hunch, but I don't know. Sarah, welcome back.
I
mean, how about
you? I can totally do 40,000 lines of code a day.
I did 40,000 in 2 weeks and got to do a conference talk about it. So you know what? If you can do it in a day, that is way more impressive.
That is. That is pretty impressive.
I mean, I write code gen tools, but you know.
I see Codeberg being successful from the standpoint of, I think it would be successful as, like, the very much co-op feeling that it seems to be portraying, to me at least, where they're not trying to be GitHub. They're not going after students and saying, here's a bunch of free credits on our AI. Go swipe your credit card and blow up your credit card bill with our AI tooling. They're very, very much saying, we're trying to offer these services to humans doing real human, you know, real projects and such, as opposed to feeding an AI machine. Such as something like GitHub or what have you, something that's larger that the LLMs are already feeding on and are abusing, that sort of thing. So I see that being like the diehards are going to probably support this and carry this for a while. And, you know, good luck to them. It's always good to have competition.
Well, I mean, this also, though, is against, like, their stance prohibits things like our partner, Code Rabbit. Like, that is a, like it or not, Code Rabbit does a great job of, like, finding bugs, finding issues in my PRs. I wouldn't code with that without it today, without something of that nature, at least. And whether that is an AI tool or, you know, take it back 5 years pre-AI, there are still, you know, analyzers and things like that. Exactly. They're all running on, you just have linters and formatters and all these other, you know, GitHub actions that would run on your code and check it for security vulnerabilities. Like, yeah, this is a more intense version of it and it's way more resource consuming, but that's how you make code more secure today. Like, that's where I have concern about it. I don't know how you'd work without that. Not how you'd work without it, but, like, I would never work without that.
I know that I poop on AI's writing code, and I will stand behind that, both for legal licensing issues and for just taking all the fun out of the job in the first place. I would rather write my own code. Thank you goddamn well very much. Shake my fist at the cloud and put an onion on my belt because that was the fashion at the time. But I actually really find, AIs, whatever the fuck you want to call them, as search agents actually really do a good job. And I can't actually poop on them too hard. As long as you're willing to, you know, not take their answers at face value, but to, like, use it as a stepping stone for further research.
Research analysis, they're so good at. And as soon as you question something, you can just say, prove it, show me the log lines. And it's either there or it's, oh, you're absolutely right. I hallucinated that for whatever reason. So I've gotten a lot of value.
They will hallucinate stuff.
Yeah.
But to that same thing, code analyzers, finding vulnerabilities, I think they actually are pretty gosh darn good at that already right now. And I will happily accept, let me be careful how I say this. I won't accept every bug report from an AI because it's not my job to validate your AI's findings. But, you know, if people would just spend 5 goddamn minutes before they pass on an AI's threat analysis. Sorry, go ahead.
No, please go ahead.
I was going to say Daniel Stenberg of the Curl Project has written extensively on this problem and has shut down his bug bounty program because of AI, because he gets so many slop reports about, hey, I wrote a test where the test program deliberately creates RCEs, and that's curl's problem because my test program links against curl. And it would have taken you so little time to just validate that this AI finding was legitimate, and you couldn't be bothered to do that. So no, I don't want to welcome such bug reports.
Okay, so what about a scenario where there's a web server serving a very popular website on the internet. Somebody goes through and grabs error logs looking for some bug that they're chasing down. They grab all the error logs, they extract all the error logs, they send Claude down a mission saying, hey, Claude, this is what I'm researching. Go find me examples. Claude finds the examples. That bug is a completely different issue. And in that research, there was 2 other bugs found. Just where the application was crashing for whatever reason. It was just like the best way to describe it was if the application had mutation testing, it probably would have caught it because it was essentially AI fuzzing the endpoint, right?
You're talking about fuzzing, which has existed before AI. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So what happened was the next step was, okay, let's write a test and having AI write the test to prove the use case. And then, okay, going in and then a human going through writing some of the code to fix the test and then having the AI go back and validate those fixes and then write up a description for a PR, submit the PR. Now, at face value,
I'll go even further. I think the AI can even do all of the fix writing as well. That's what I'm thinking.
Okay.
As long as there is a human with a vested interest who is doing the validation of the fix,
yes,
before it is demanding time from project maintainers. Yes.
How do developers demonstrate that they have taken that time and done that due diligence in their PR and in their change? And that's the confidence they're bringing by even opening the PR compared to somebody who's just having AI slop generate PRs. Because
I'll say this, if you can make a one paragraph statement summarizing at a high level what's going on in the vulnerability, then you put in enough work. An AI, it will either, so if it's not a legit thing, it will write the summary that will tell you that it's not a legit thing because it says, oh, you know, I wrote this this exec call into my repro script, and the exec call is accepting arguments from the command line. That tells you that that's a BS thing. And you've gotten out of the way of the first paragraph. What we see are reports where it's 3 pages worth of narrative. And in the middle of it, it's diverging to talk about something completely unrelated. And you have to get through all of it if you realize this was a slop report.
Right.
Those are the ones that I really feel have wasted time. So somebody submitted that bug, write that first elevator pitch paragraph that says, fundamentally, here's what went wrong.
Right. Now, I who uses AI tools a lot, and I'm trying to use them for the greater good to solve other issues and just do more with open source. But I don't want to be thought of, or I don't want to mess with my reputation that I have in the community of somebody who's just throwing slop PRs around. Right. So it's very I'm trying to solve these problems because I just noticed that they were there. For me, it was a very low effort to solve the problem because I had Claude do it. I had the AI agent do it. And then I spent 30, 45 minutes after the fact going, oh, this is actually solving the problem. Okay, cool.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, you're talking about reputational systems, and like in a perfect world, that kind of thing is going to work so that you care about this project. And you have a history of bringing real issues to this project, and somebody could say, oh, Bob Fredson over here, like, always submits really great bug reports. Let's see what they've submitted this time. It's probably going to be good quality. Two problems with that. One is all of the young people submitting bug reports, it can be hard to even get in the front door if you've got 1,000 people submitting slop and one person is trying to break in with their first good bug report. It's harder to build up reputation than it's ever been because of the volume. And two has already escaped my brain because I'm still
Let's flip this and say, like, you can use AI as a defensive thing as well. It's like, let Claude take the first pass and say, hey, screen all these, only give you the ones that are legitimate. Like, what do you think of using that kind of a defensive layer of Claude?
I think it's risky because my brain immediately jumps to, well, using AI to screen human job applications is proven to be a giant shit show. Should we really have it be the first round of screening anything? I mean, security things could be so subjective too. I don't know. I think that would be an expensive operation to have Claude or Fable or something of that level be able to take what you would assume is a legit security report and actually be able to what would you expect them to be able to do? Triage it, maybe execute a proof of concept and then escalate that to a human and remove maybe a needs triage label on GitHub. I mean, that might be asking a lot.
I was just going to say, starting at a basic level, I would just say, like, does the bug they describe here actually, like, apply? And your curl was a great example of this. Does this actually apply to my project, or is this something adjacent to it that they're blaming on me? Like, that is a question Claude could convincingly answer every single time. And I think that would be the first step. Sarah, go ahead.
Could it answer that every single time? Because that fix that was probably written by an AI, it was not convinced that it was wrong about creating that thing in the first place. Like, if AI could detect bug reports that aren't valid, then AI should be able to know not to create the bug report in the first place, no?
That's actually not really the case. So you can make AI say
I know it's not, and that's a problem.
So, no, there's a lot of use cases. In fact, like, and mobile does this quite a bit, where you'll have two different contexts. So I was at a different conference. There's Laracon is going on, or just ending, ended. I wasn't there. But I was at a mobile developer meetup Tuesday night. And one of the presenters was talking about how they use Apple Intelligence to generate summaries of baseball or of basketball games. So they take a wall of text, they feed it in, they generate three sentences, and they come out the other side. But the problem is, like, there's so many failure modes. So what they do, they'd have a second context, essentially, that, like, okay, read the summary here, verify all the facts based on the first one. And so they would have two separate contexts, even though they're the same model, working against each other to ensure that, like, what comes out is actually true. So there's no, like, winner inversion. There's no, like, and a nail biter game 19 points apart, nothing of that nature. So that is actually a very common use case to have, even though it's still Claude on both sides of it. Claude coming from the one side and Claude to verify it on the other side, it works fairly well.
But cannot the submitting side have both of those Claudes fighting with each other before
they
it's ever
created? Absolutely could, but people are dumb. This is where people are dumb, because they could say, like, okay, we've generated this report. Now, before we submit it, can we verify all the findings in this? That would be all it would take to say, let's verify all of our findings. Let's check everything back to the source. And the AI would pretty convincingly say, no, actually, what we found here is kind of garbage. That is totally reasonable and could happen if the person decided to do that. That's even where, like, I get angry at all the bug report spam, because that would be all it would take, would be, okay, let's check this one more time before we submit. You don't even have to do the work yourself. Just ask Claude to double check it before you hit the send button.
I call on project maintainers to submit every single slop report as spam. Mark it as spam so that GitHub will just freaking ban that account eventually. That there should be consequences for wasting
people's
time, is what I'm saying.
Absolutely. On the subject of Laracon.
Fuck you for supporting open source.
How are you doing so bad? Like, Eric is doing better production value than this lately. What's
I know. I'm doing it again. I'm just off my game today. So the problem was you asked, you said that you weren't at Laracon, but Eric was at Laracon. So all of the PHP Arch employees have been without Eric's torment and yelling at us constantly during the workday. So
productivity is at an all-time high.
Morale is fantastic. I did yell at Frank yesterday just because I felt like he was doing too good. So I needed to bring Frank down a peg. But yeah, so Eric was at Laracon this week and he saw some pretty cool things. He sent me a huge message about how I need to change my life and adopt Laravel Cloud, or else he's going to try to fire me or something. I don't know. But I'm still waiting on the invite to our Laravel Cloud account before I actually go do anything. So the coolest thing, in my opinion, that was announced at Laracon is what they're calling the scale to zero for Laravel Cloud. So if you're not familiar with Laravel Cloud, it is a paid solution of hosting your Laravel application in essentially what is AWS's ECS system. It makes, if you've ever used Laravel Forge, it makes using and spinning up a VPS super easy. It's the same thing for ECS in AWS, where it's a Elastic Container Service. So everything is essentially in a cage-like environment. But what they have perfected, or what they have been working on, is they can have your whole stack, your application server, your Valkey queue, and your MySQL database all scale to zero if it's not being used. So that could be a game changer for a side project that you have that only has a few users during a day, and then maybe it has a huge burst during the evening if it's like a gaming type of thing, or if it's just something that's just not hit, it doesn't have to be online constantly. And the first thing you say is, okay, well, what are these cold start times, right? That's always the first thing. And they show a couple of demos here where these sites, like, it's less than 500 milliseconds, if not faster than that, on how fast they're resuming these services. So you can actually go through and scale all your infrastructure down to zero, where you're not paying for anything running. And then as soon as it gets a web request, everything spins right back up, just like it was. Caches come back up, everything's operating. That's pretty powerful if you don't have your own DevOps army or DevOps team to do that kind of, to build that kind of functionality for you. If that's something that your project needs, that could be a huge game changer.
It could be. Are they using like WASM or what are they doing?
I actually haven't looked into it yet, so I'm not sure how they accomplished it. They did say, like, you know, this was an iteration that they had originally done where they just weren't happy with the restart times, right? Mm-hmm. But at this point, the demo that I saw that Taylor did live on stage was essentially he let the infrastructure all go to sleep, scaled down to zero, and then just opened a browser tab, hit the URL, and it all spun right back up just within. Like, you could probably tell, like, if you were looking for it, you could tell that there was a little bit of extra time on the request. But if you weren't paying attention and the site just came up, you wouldn't have known any different.
That's pretty impressive. Those Laravel folk are always up to something.
Yeah, and it's pretty cool to bring that kind of capacity and auto scaling abilities too. They really do a good job of the syntactic sugar of making me. Are making things available to without the complexity, because what's going on behind the scenes here is really complex and there's a lot of moving parts, and that's not what it's exposed to the client, which is really cool.
How do you spin up a MySQL instance that fast? Like,
I have a Docker. Feeling Eric's. Yeah, it's definitely some kind of pausing container or stopping an instance sort of thing. I have a feeling Eric will probably set us up an account and give me some toys to go play with.
That is kind of crazy. Yeah, it's got to be like just a pause resume function. They can't start it cold, like cold.
No.
Yeah.
Some of the other things that were announced at Laracon is that there's a Laravel language server protocol, and you get some better autocomplete in your editor and some better code navigation, because you're essentially using AI to tell you the editor where things are. You can also run managed queues was the other Laravel cloud thing. So you can run your managed queues, and you can even scale your queues to zero too. So they'll only wake up if there's a job that needs to be fired, and they'll go right back to zero. So pretty cool. I look forward to kind of checking that out.
I feel like I have nothing to contribute here.
I want to jump back for a comment that came in our chat here a little bit ago, just because it's kind of a pet peeve of mine. David Stockton said on our YouTube stream, he said that, you know, Claude, produce the show, make no mistakes. That is a kind of a pet peeve of mine, where people say like the make no mistakes part, because it does. That's exactly what I was talking about, like using two instances of the AI to like be adversarial to itself.
But that's the joke, though.
I know, yeah. But
that's the bit.
If make no mistakes worked, it would be in the standard preamble. On right?
So yeah. Many people are putting it in there, though. If you actually start seeing some of these prompts people are shipping into apps and for websites and things, they actually are putting that in there. And like, if
people also put posts on Facebook saying, I do not give consent for Mark Zuckerberg to sell my personal data. Like, people are dumb, okay?
I still love, like, again, mobile apps are like compiled, and people think that like nobody's going to see my stuff. You can dump a mobile app real quick, get strings out of it, and you can see all these prompts and like JavaScript code that they're shipping in their app. You're like,
yep.
APK is just a zip file.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yeah.
Oh my god, you hacked my APK.
Right. C sharp, you can completely decompile anything that's C sharp.
Yeah.
Like people think that, oh, it compiles, it's secure. No, like you can get back, you can recover the original code. Same thing for most of Java code. You can get that back. So like, it's not implicitly more secure. Oh, because PHP is not compiled. No, it's the same thing. Like you can recover the code. Who cares? In fact, PHP, at least you're not shipping the code. All right. We are running a little long here.
Any last things we want to cover before we kick it off for the week?
I finally got your message, Sarah, where you're, why you had to disappear. Apparently I'm on a little bit of a delay. It came through during like the last 20 seconds.
Wait, literally, wow. Like it wasn't a scrolling problem.
That was
just
very
like
delayed.
The message literally just doesn't come in.
It just buzzed on my watch of like, Sarah sent a message.
Oh, wow. Okay, I got nothing for you. Then learn American Sign Language, okay? Because I also, like...
You know, people are going to watch this, and they're going to be like, let's loop back on Sarah, see what she's signing.
Yeah, they're going to complain about my sign accent, which sucks, because I don't actually know much. I just know enough to deal with when I go nonverbal. I made up a sign for Joe's name in the middle of that. I'm just like, well, I know coffee, so I'm just going to say Joe. Because it's a cup of Joe.
It works, yeah.
Yeah.
Wait, so as part of being in Portugal, are you having to learn like Portuguese sign language now too? Or are you learning like different dialects?
I haven't investigated Portuguese sign language yet. I spent the past 3 weeks, 20 hours a week learning spoken Portuguese. I'll worry about the sign language. See, the thing is, I have almost nobody around me who knows any sign language at all. So, like, the Brits that I have in my life, I'm just like, here's some American Sign Language. You want me to do BSL, that's your problem.
Okay, honestly, it never occurred to me that British Sign Language was a thing. Like, I just like, that's English.
It's a thing.
This has been PHP Podcast, the official podcast of PHP Architect, the industry's leading tech magazine and publisher focused on PHP and web development. Subscribe today at phparch.com to see what the leaders in the community and industry are talking about.